You are listening to 4D Forages. On this episode, we have Peter Walsh and Stephen O'Malley in conversation about Scott Walker, and in particular, Soused, a collaborative album from Scott Walker and Sun, which was co-produced and recorded by Peter. Peter Walsh is an award-winning record producer, sound engineer and mixer, whose career spans from the early 1980s through to the present day. He has worked with a broad variety of artists, but is probably best known for his work with Simple Minds, Peter Gabriel, Pulp, FKA Twigs and Daniel Bloomberg. Peter Walsh was a close collaborator of Scott Walker's, working with him from 1984's Climate of Hunter up until Scott's death in 2019. Stephen O'Malley is a guitarist, composer and founding member of Sun. Stephen is also the curator of record label Ideologic Organ. Sun have a new album coming later this year via Sub Pop, which you should check out when you can.
We should be recording this too, because this is like what happens in the
We are recording this.
Oh, perfect. Because I wanted to say these earthworks, I used them last year in a session I was doing.
Yeah.
And we recorded in this big barn in Woodstock, New York, actually. Yeah. And the tracking room's this big barn.
Beautiful.
With the earthworks like up in the back.
Right.
Isn't that amazing?
They're incredible mics, yeah. And in fact, we used a couple of earthworks on the sessions with Scott.
On the guitars,
yeah. As ambience.
A little bit back, because that room where we had all the gear, this is a good way to start.
Yes.
I remember having a couple of calls with you about how to record our rig.
Yeah.
Sun's rig, because our idea was to bring the entire live rig to the studio.
That's right.
But not really knowing what the studio would be. And I don't think any of us really realized what the studio was until quite late.
Yeah.
And we came in and it was a live room, but it was quite small. So we put the entire Sun back line in there, about 8 or 10 stacks. This is one of the questions I wanted to ask you because you, in our conversations on the phone too, you were talking about how you wanted to use a lot of microphones on different speakers, but even on the same speaker cabinet have several different options and stuff.
Yeah.
So how many do you remember how you did that miking on the...
I do actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the studio was West Point.
West Point Studio.
In Acton. Yeah. Yeah. And... We'd worked there quite a lot, Scott and I, on Bish Bosh, I think.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
And it was quite a modern studio. I think Kylie Minogue's producer had at one point owned it, and it just seemed to really work. And it had the additional bonus that it was quite close to where Scott lived.
Yeah.
So he liked to sort of jump out of bed and get down to the studio.
Cycle over. I remember.
Cycle over, exactly. Cycle over. Yeah.
That was really cool.
Yeah. So we did know the space, and I was a little worried. I think it was over Christmas that this was all being planned. And I remember trying to, in my head, or maybe you told me, how many cabinets we were going to be using. Mm-hmm. So I was thinking, okay, so there's three in a row, and then there's the two Ampegs in the middle, and then there's three 4x12s on the right. So I was trying to imagine how wide that would be. And I remember driving up there over Christmas to have a look at the room and see if it would fit in. And it looked like it would, but I was very nervous about on the day whether... when you put the people in there as well, and then all the sort of pedals and, but it was a perfect fit, and there wasn't as much ambience in the room as I would have probably liked or chosen. You'd kind of want to have a larger room and get a bit of distance from the speakers, but in fact, miking it up. It's a kind of rectangular room, and we used the sort of long side to put it was like a huge hi-fi system in a way, we've got Greg's rig on the left, was it?
Mm-hmm.
Like with the double stack and then two half stacks next to it. Then two Ampegs for TOS, was it? Which is where all the bass Moogs were going through.
Yeah, TOS would play a Moog Rogue for the bass, but mm-hmm. we would also do bass guitar there.
Yeah. And then your Stephen's rig on the right. So
yeah,
it kind of, when you see it, it looks right, doesn't it? It sort of is, yeah. Like, okay. And also great for a stereo perspective, which is something I really wanted to get, was a performance, which is what we were going for, but kind of a more controlled performance in a way, because mm-hmm. it had to match Scott's skeleton, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
He had made a sort of a sketch of the tracks mm-hmm. beforehand, so we had bar lengths, everything was kind of arranged. So
yeah, and the timing and the meter, it was very metric, actually.
Yeah.
And that's one, there's one place that Sun contributed to the meter by extending it a little bit or slowing it,
mm-hmm.
but on agreement, because that was affecting the entire composition. But there were scores as well. We were reading scores for some of the pieces for the guitar, and we were conducted also by Mark Gorman.
Exactly. We had
it was a real, like, it was an ensemble performance, which I mm-hmm, thought was mm-hmm. It was different for us, and it was challenging to have such a emphasis on a regularity with meter. Sun's music is dealing a lot with the flexibility of perception of temporality, essentially, most of the time. So coming into that, it wasn't rigid, though. It was just a different type of discipline of, like, execution, which I over the years have realized, and from conversation with Scott, where he told me, he was like, oh, you know, the low brass, low strings, that's what you guys are doing.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
I'm like, okay, yeah. It's an ensemble. We're the ensemble, the orchestra. That's our function.
Yeah.
In these compositions he made. And that's really beautiful.
That's interesting you say that he said that to you, because I read an interview he did about this, and he was saying that the drones fill in the silence for him,
mm-hmm.
where in his normal sort of album, in his albums,
mm-hmm.
Where there would be silence and then a vocal,
mm-hmm.
silence vocal, the drones were sort of, gave it a sort of continuous rolling motion.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was listening to it the other day, and I was thinking, you know, this is really, these are the strings, these are our sort of pad sounds, these mm-hmm. are that when he meant silence, I think in the interview I think he was meaning not silence, because they are the strings, they are, and everything sort of in a normal Scott album, everything would sort of hang off the you know, the harmony. Mm. I mean, that's where the drones are. Okay, it's they're drones, but that's where the harmony is, and everything.
They're harmonic. Exactly. Yeah, it's a harmony.
That's where that's where everything kind of springs off, as opposed to on his albums, where it would be the strings or you know, some other kind of texture. So it's the textural glue, isn't it, to the album, you know?
Yeah, it's like the ether or ether between.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Do you think that he might have meant that the silence was a period of non, like a non-narrative activity, actually,
mm-hmm.
somehow?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Like
yeah,
a space, actually a space.
It's a space, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But not an empty space, just a different space.
There you are. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. So we came into this room, and rolling all that stuff in the studio into West Point. One of the things about West Point we discovered right away was it had white carpeting.
There you go. You were asked to take your shoes off. Yeah. I seem to remember.
Yeah. We had like jack boots on and stuff.
You did. And I was actually quite nervous about that. I thought, oh, this is, because we haven't met before.
Yeah, we met. We met in the studio in the evening. I think Toss and I drove over from France with all of my gear.
That's right.
And I was like, oh, nice to meet you, Pete. Here we are. And then immediately we're working essentially. And actually, the entire session was, we were just working all the time, but it wasn't like forced labor. It was because the creativity, it was just a charged creativity.
Exactly.
At least that was my experience.
Yeah, I should probably, just, we touched on it just a while back, but when I was saying that we'd been in the studio prior to that with Scott.
Yeah.
Where we built a sketch for you guys.
Yeah.
And it was a similar kind of process that we normally have. You know, you mentioned with Mark conducting. So Mark Warman, our musical director, and for me and Scott, and we basically, Scott had worked out what he wanted to do on his keyboard.
Yeah.
On sort of internal sequencer, and we then transferred all of that stuff into our world, built the sessions, made the demos, so to speak. So, so we had a framework ready for you guys to then come in and start replacing all of the all of our sort of guide drones and.
That's one thing that was quite striking for us was they were fully realized compositions that needed to be the color needed to be put into them, and that's that was our function. It wasn't that we were co-writing. I mean, Scott clearly composed everything, and I just wanted to tell one story about that, about the demos and about coming into that, because that was also something a son had never done before. Any of our collaborations involves co-writing in the studio.
Right.
And I had first reached out to Scott in 2008 or 7 via Ed from 4AD, via Sean Kendrick.
Right.
It was a producer we worked with. And at the time, Son was working on a record called Monoliths and Dimensions, and we had one piece of music there that, at the time, I had a lot of motivation to contact these like singers I idolized and was a huge fan of. And there's one piece I was like, I'm just, Sean Kendrick told me maybe Ed could pass on a letter or something to Scott's people and stuff like that. It was really many layers, and we did that and sent this music over, and that album had all these interesting jazz players on it, like progressive people, and Richard Serra artwork was set up for the cover and stuff. It was for us, it was our like really breakthrough art project, our biggest artistic project. And to our surprise, we got a response, because I didn't really expect to get through. No one talks to Scott Walker, right? Like, who knows him? No one. We didn't know anyone who knew him. We knew a lot of people. He's like a myth. But we got a response, and it was Charles and Kathy Negus Fancy, who were Scott's managers. It's like, Scott wants you to know. He really appreciates you reaching out, and he likes your music. He's a fan, you know, he's aware of you guys. He's a fan. He appreciates you reaching out, but he doesn't like the arrangements in this track, but thank you and good luck and stuff like that. And just that alone was incredible to receive.
Yeah.
But, you know, 5 years later, we got a kind of cold call email, also via Charles, or a forwarded written a note from Scott saying, hey, it was so casual. I just want to say this story because it's reflects a side of humanity and just like pure creativity, I think is really important to express about Scott too. My experience of knowing him for the time I did. It's like, I've been thinking about this collaboration, and I actually wrote some songs for you guys. We made a demo. Would you be interested to hear it? It was so down to earth, and I got the I was up in Seattle. I got the email, and I had to sit down. I was walking down the street, and I had to sit down on someone's porch. I didn't know. It's like, and I called.
Wait a minute.
Yeah, like I called Greg. I'm like, I think we just got a demo proposal from Scott Walker. And I was like, yes, sir, we would like to hear the demo. And
I can imagine, yeah.
It was so right on to hear those compositions. It was like, this guy really understands us. You know,
right.
We didn't write these riffs and stuff in that way, but he designed a frame for us to play with our personality and character that felt, to me, it felt really natural. Like, oh, this sounds like something that Greg and I would have come up with if we were writing.
Yeah.
It was like, it was a pre-production demo, the way you describe
it. That's right.
Like, you take this in to the studio and that's your map.
That's what we would have done.
Yeah.
And you know, probably at least a week's work, I would say, just to do that process of getting all the information off his keyboard. And
it was so moving that he, after 5 years, was still, first of all, still thinking about us, and took the time to write this stuff and work with you the other musicians he had scratching the stuff out to do that, and then to reach out so humbly. It still blows my mind, because he was probably, I don't know how old he was at the time, 71, 72 maybe, in 2013. He was in the 70s. Early 70s. It's like, he's done all of this stuff in his life that's been monumental to me and a lot of people, and artistic, just on purely artistic terms. And pop is a whole nother part of it, which I didn't really... I got into his art, high art, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Stuff he made with you.
Yeah.
And it's been so inspiring and motivating for my own music. And but that someone would, like, after I just, like, proposed he sing on a Sun track, he would remember that after all those years.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not some, like, experimental guy from Poland, like a no name. It's Scott Walker. It was so moving. And I think that really, I mean, and then meeting you and talking with you, meeting Mark, meeting Kathy and Charles, Ed and Sam, like everyone was so welcoming in their way, and creatively too, as artists too. I felt completely like embraced by this project, and it was, that still moves me now. And that was over 10 years ago. I mean, I'm talking about 15 years from when I first wrote to him.
It's kind of
wild. And
what's interesting about we're listening back to those sketches that we made, is that he was probably listening to Monoliths and Dimensions as his kind of, you know, starting point in a way to get your thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a, it's almost like a pastiche of that record, I think, where there's like a lot of the treatments and sort of not just the drones, but the kind of grinding and sort of mashing up of sounds and things.
Mm-hmm.
He was obviously kind of, he had probably started that process right when he had that record, you know.
Thinking about it. Yeah.
And it's amazing how when you listen to even the finished product now, how there are, I can hear reference points. I can picture him listening to that and going, okay, well, we're going to do it my way, but this is our starting point, you know. So
he wanted to go into it also being understanding in a real way of what we're capable of too.
Yeah, I mean, preparation was his big thing, and mine too, as you noticed when you came in.
Yeah, here,
it was like just press record and off we go, you know, because you can't you can't miss a thing, you know.
Yeah.
So no, he would have been thinking about it, and as you've said, many years, and making sure he had exactly the right kind of framework to put this in and make it your record and his record together.
Yeah.
So, you know, he was very, very clear about that, you know.
But it's like the space that was granted to us to sort of enrich in all of those frequencies spectrally was great.
Mm.
And there was a pretty heavy experimental side of doing that.
Oh, there was,
things.
Yeah. In fact, the demos were done with samples.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
Wouldn't have been a real performance though.
The guitar as well.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, and it was really when we started recording the Sun guitars.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it was like the whole world opened up. You know, it was like suddenly there's all these harmonics and sort of. The performance, you know, every sort of bar is a different, you know, it's a sustain, it's like having a living animal come into the room. I did try and work out how many watts it was at one point, but I know it had a profound effect on everyone. I mean, I've worked with, you know, a lot of guitars, a lot of different genres, but so I was kind of prepared for it, but I know that Scott and Mark, I don't think they'd ever heard that much sort of power in a sort of one strike, you know, and it really did sort of, it came up at you. It was a physical thing, you know, it wasn't just an aural kind of sensation. It was this energy came up through the floor and, kind of just takes over your body. And I just remember Scott going, you know, like, Jesus, you know, this is really, really loud. Did you know it was going to be this loud? I was like, well, yeah, if you look at the gear in here, there was a good chance it was going to make this noise, you know. But yeah, I mean, we were just, it was like a, you know, in a way I've said this before, it was controlled, but what I loved about it was that it had a movement in it and a wave and a cycle that so it was breathing, and in our demos we'd just been listening to sort of like one thing, which was obviously making us, you know, that's the idea of a demo, it's making you think of what it can sound like, but suddenly we had the real thing there, and it you know, I think it really opened up the music, you know, and it's then how you sort of use it, how you capture it, and that's the difficult part in a way for us to capture it, because we needed particular lengths of each note needed particular lengths. I remember Mark, you know, conducting you guys and following a score
with. Big ear defenders.
Exactly. The So he's like counting sort of, or he's, we had a monitor in a screen. And so he could see our arrangement. So counting the bars, and then he'd give you guys a sort of, what? I don't know why he was whispering, because you wouldn't have heard him anyway, but he'd give you the cue to change, you know, to play the next note sort of thing. And the accidents were great as well, you know. Like I was saying, it had its own life, so the bits of feedback were all part of it. And I think we had more than we wanted, you know, sort of tried a few takes and
That's the thing about Sun, it's just excessive.
Yeah.
I always have a lot more than you need of every aspect.
Yeah.
For me, the sessions were really, it was like a masterclass of producing and what you can do with a small team too. Watching the three of you and Scott and Mark working together, it was really inspiring to me.
Thank you.
For my own music, because we had come from a place that was similar to that somehow, like just a few people making the resources go as far as they can, not wasting time, not screwing around in the studio. And I remember having a bunch of conversations about with Scott too, about like how he used to record with his, well, with the Walker brothers and stuff, like really economically. And it sounded like, oh, that's how we record with our band or all of our bands in the past, because make the most of the time and be as prepared as possible to get the best performance, not spend 3 days doing a guitar solo or something like
that's
that.
That's right.
You know, where it, maybe you need that time to find like the God solo, but it can also dilute the fire. And in that session, in the South session, the fire was so strong, but the three of you guys working together, it was like, wow, this is really incredible how articulate it is and clear. It allows to direct us to do our, you know, and to do our, the most we can
to focus on
in a way that wasn't unnatural. It was really, really cool, and I brought a lot from that session. And you know, I feel like I learned so much in that session.
Well, thank you for saying
like cooperation
that,
and like the human element of what it takes to really make to collaborate on music recordings. Yeah,
I think it's so important. You know, you can be in the best studio in the world with the best microphones in the world, with, you know, set the whole thing up perfectly, but it's not just a sort of technical thing. It's actually when the artist comes in to the studio, you're ready for them and everything is laid out, everything's checked. On every session with Scott, I would usually get into the studio a couple of hours before anybody else arrived. Because I knew that, you know, 9 times out of 10, 5 minutes before he arrived, something would break, something would go wrong. It's like, you know, people hurrying around trying to fix it. But the main reason for that is that Scott could be put off very quickly when things didn't run, you know, as he, you know, when there was a hiccup. It would kind of, obviously, no one wants that sort of delays and stuff, but I consider one of my main functions with him was to be able to, when he walked through the door, to be able to sit down and talk to him and not worry about the technical side and not worry about anything that was going on in the studio, because I knew that it was all ready and all I had to do was hit record and we'd get something, you know, and I think that's what he saw in me. There was a trust in there, and he knew I'd been in there and set everything up and got it all ready. And I think that attitude is towards recording is really, really important, because you know, we are, in a way, you know, we're the background to it. I like to think that, you know, we make it all work and make it easy for artists, you know, people like yourself to come in and
you enable an artist to stay in their flow state.
Exactly. Yeah.
And that that's
I like that.
Yeah. That has no, the value of that is, it doesn't have anything to do with economy. It has to do with like the real energy of creation, you know.
Yeah.
So if you can have the trust that if I get on a roll, and maybe, you know, an artist doesn't know when that happens all the time, but when you're in the studio as a musician, hopefully it's happening, because that's the time for it to really
Exactly. And I mean, the chances are that, you know, you get a few hiccups and things, that'll stop it for sure, you know, so.
Yeah, a technical issue can delay things for 20 minutes, and then someone goes out for a cigarette or goes to lunch, or they're girlfriend comes over, and then it's just like
it's keeping everybody engaged, focused, moving in the same direction, you know?
because to get to those further places, to those frontiers where you haven't been, it takes time and non-distraction in that way.
True.
right? True. But the Sun session, it lasted a small week. And originally, Soust was, the demo is 4 pieces, but the album is 5 pieces. So one interesting thing that happened was we were very efficient in doing all of the Sun parts, and we had an extra day and a half, I think. And when we finished the planned tracking for, it might have been Ball, the last track mm-hmm. we did, or the fourth track of the demo, of the original 4 pieces. We're like, oh, we still have some more time. And then I remember a conversation we had all together, and Scott was like, do you guys still have time? We're like, yeah, we're here for the duration, of course. It's like, well, I wish I wrote some more music for you guys. Like, would you be willing to work tomorrow too if I had something? Like, yeah, of course. This is the last day of a once in a lifetime situation. Of course, we're gonna, you know, experience this as deeply as possible. And he kind of left the studio, and we went out and had a beer or something and agreed to come back in the morning and see what was going on. And he came back and the next morning he came. We always would come early too. You would be there, then Son would show up, and then Scott would show up. Mm. And he came in, and I think he had already spoken to you and Mark about the piece Lullaby.
Yeah.
Bye, Bye, Bye was the title of that piece mm-hmm, that he wrote, mm-hmm. written for Ute Lemper.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
And he said, well, I wrote this song for Ute Lemper. Have you heard it? I was like, yeah, that's an incredible piece of music and mm-hmm. performance mm-hmm. and lyrically, like, very, very complex and deep. And he's like, okay, let's work on that today and see what, because I never sang this song. And we did all the tracking somehow. Mark and you and Scott, I suppose, mm-hmm. were able to dissect perpetuate his compositionals into scores for us to do our parts. And that's just incredible that happened, because I think that's of the 5 tracks on the album, that's the last track. Lyrically, it's dealing with quite spiritual topics.
Absolutely,
yeah. And political topics. And I always wondered, is that the last vocal he recorded for the album?
Ooh,
because Soust was the last vocal performance he made.
True.
On record. On recording. Do you know? Do you remember how? Because Son had our own session, but the other instruments and Scott's singing, those were in separate sessions, of which exactly, we were not part of.
Yeah.
And I had some questions about those sessions.
Right, yeah.
And that's my first question of that.
Yeah, so I can't say for sure if it was the last vocal he ever sang, but certainly the projects we did after Soust were soundtracks, mm-hmm. obviously for the 2 Brady Corbett films,
Childhood of a Leader
and Vox Lux.
And Vox Lux, yeah.
And we did a couple of modern dance pieces.
Ballet Boys, that's it.
Which was performed at Sadler's Wells.
Oh, yeah.
Which you went to, didn't you?
Yeah, I performed there in 2-3 years ago. Actually, this could be a segue to another topic too.
Right.
With a piece I did,
I remember,
with Giselle Vienne,
yeah,
who directed the Brando video.
That's true. Yeah.
And actually, that piece goes back to an earlier conversation we're having today, because that piece was that was the first piece I worked with EarCam and multi-channel spatialization.
Ah, right. Yeah. Okay.
In 2009, so.
Right.
Right around then. So the Ballet Boys piece was
Sadler's. That was
Sadler's.
Yeah. At Sadler's, yeah. And there was another soundtrack we recorded for the Wild Up Festival, performed at the Walt Disney Concert Hall.
Oh, yeah.
So... And that was So no, there weren't any more vocal projects that we did, you know.
Were the vocals the last of the tracking for the album? The last element of this track?
Yes, I think so, yeah.
Was that typical for what your projects together?
Yeah, I mean, I think, we like to get all the music done first. Yeah. And he liked to sing to a sort of complete backing track, so he... You know,
it must have been a thrill.
Yeah, absolutely.
Set up the whole thing, and then he gets to sing over his like vision.
Yeah.
Come to life.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, we, as you mentioned earlier, we generally had the. Well, things changed over the years. I mean, back in the first time I worked with him, on Climate of Hunter.
Yeah.
There were. I think I've mentioned this quite often, but there were the melody was. Because we hadn't demoed the album, there was no reference to the melody. Mm-hmm. It only appeared as on the score as notes, you know. But we didn't have a sort of reference to the melody whilst we were working. But on Soust, in fact, everything after Tilt, I think we had this. He used to sketch out the keyboard mm-hmm. melody on an electric piano, so. Mm-hmm. You could kind of hear where the melody was going to be and know that what you were, where you were recording was, you know, okay, let's be careful here because there's a voice and...
Oh, and the range and
the
everything.
The range and everything, yeah. Oh, so, yeah. But it was always replacing that electric piano vocal line was always a joy. It was like sort of, eating up the... Just getting rid of it, all the stuff that we didn't want to use, and replacing it with the vocal. And it was a great sort of experience with Scott, sort of just being with him on his own, sort of one to one, just him and me working through it. Just
the vocal sessions were always. Very close sessions, right?
They were.
Just the two of you guys.
That's right.
Not even the, like, a studio assistant or anything.
No.
That's really special.
Yeah. Yeah. It was great. And he would generally just sort of not want to talk a lot at the mm-hmm. beginning. He'd sort of preserve his voice for as long mm-hmm. as he could.
Mm-hmm.
So he had that sort of, and we'd always pick a certain point of the song to start off with. It wouldn't necessarily be the beginning. If it was an early morning performance, he'd maybe try and get some of the sort of low range stuff, so he'd have more resonance in his voice mm-hmm. then, you know. And in a way, it was a kind of a way of kind of warming up the voice, you know, because you wouldn't want to start sort of blasting a sort of the chorus, so to speak, or a high range part of the song.
I love listening to Drupad singers. There's a few I've seen who will sing for 2 hours or in a concert, 2 hours or more even.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the first hour is really, I mean, it's in front of the full audience, the full thing. But they're still like cracking, their voice is cracking, and they're, you know, drinking water, getting at the, but just allowing you to go through that process of the sort of the intoning of the vocal cords is so special.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally.
Sounds like you would do that through the day with mm-hmm, Scott.
Mm-hmm. In fact, the process would actually start even before we got to the studio, because I would actually never know whether we were going to record the vocal or not.
Oh.
And I'd get a phone call from Scott's manager, Kathy.
Uh-huh.
Kathy Negus Fancy. And we'd have everything set up, but studio on hold and everything ready to go. But he'd always leave the final decision until the morning
mm-hmm.
that he had to sing to actually confirm whether he was going to come in or not.
Yeah.
I mean, you could kind of tell from the build-up whether it was going to happen or not.
Mm-hmm.
There were a few sort of pointers, you know, if he suffered quite badly from hay fever. So, you know, when the pollen was out, you'd look at the, you know, are we recording today? Well, let's check the pollen count. You know, I don't know. It's So, you know, also how he, you know, how he had slept the night before, if he'd been up late. You know, I think he, I don't know. I think he had, had, you know, he was a bit of a night owl.
Yeah.
So, you know, you had to have a good night's sleep and, you know, it's sort of like you come in sometimes and sort of say, man, the pizza man woke me up last night, you know, he was banging on my door, you know, trying to deliver pizza. I've told him, so, you know, it's just like this whole thing. You go, okay, so we're not going to be recording the vocal today, you know, so. But yeah, anyway, we, you know, I'd get the call early on in the morning and then drive into the studio and get it all ready for him. But it was lovely, you know. I miss it very much.
Do you can you talk a little bit about the how you would mic him for the vocal takes on Soust at least?
I mean, we use the same mic on pretty much everything that I recorded with him, and it was a Neumann U47.
Okay.
U48 actually.
Okay.
Which my brother owns.
Okay.
And way back on Climate, we did a whole load of tests. We rented a whole load of these microphones, and I thought, you know, we need to have some consistency with the sound, and it just so happened that this U48 came up and my brother was in a position to buy it, so we sort of went in and we got this mic. So that became Scott's mic, and I always used that mic.
So you used the same microphone for 30 years?
Yeah.
Exclusively. Incredible.
Yeah.
I saw on the, I was looking over the credits, and I was wondering what the special thanks was for.
For Greg?
Yeah. Because he's listed in our thanks list here.
Oh, is he? Yeah, that's right. Yeah. No, he's
Greg Walsh for the Neumann microphone.
That's right. Yeah. So that was one of the big kind of what can be quite a time-consuming sort of moment when you come to do vocals with any artist. It's like, are we getting the best out of the voice? Are we, you know, do we feel comfortable with this? And we'd already kind of got rid of that. And as soon as Scott saw that mic, he was like, okay, yeah, now I know.
Mm-hmm.
I know what I'm doing, sort of thing. So, that was the mic. He had a jug of water. I mean, normal stuff, you know. And we worked so long together, you know.
Yeah.
It was like 35 years that I've been recording his vocals. From Climate of Hunter through till his passing. And so headphone, I knew exactly what he needed in the headphones, what he was referencing to, what he listened to and stuff. But we love working analog. So as the digital technology sort of started to influence the way everybody was working, we made the change, I think, on the drift over to digital. But one thing we did was we always recorded the drums and the vocals to analog as well. So tape. Yeah.
So the vocals on Soust
are mostly analog.
Wow.
Yeah. So
that's interesting.
I developed this technique of running the vocal parallel through a tape machine and direct to hard disk, so direct to the Pro Tools session. So I would actually record everything with a digital signal and a signal coming off tape. And then I would, because the vocal on tape was slightly delayed.
Yeah.
Got to
the latency.
The latency, exactly. Yeah. I'd shift everything back a few, I can't remember how many samples it was, but and then get them phasing so they're in exactly the same place. And it was great having the two signals there, because when the track was very quiet and there was nothing underneath and we felt like the tape hiss was distracting from the silence, mm-hmm. then I just put the digital one in.
Yeah.
And when we needed a big sounding voice, then, you know, like how the album opens, you know, with Brando, this big kind of operatic, loud vocal, you know, that would be sort of, you get that sort of really nice kind of analog warmth there. Mm-hmm. Usually actually when he was pushing, and things were peaking sort of in the midst, it would be nice to sort of have the analog, because it would just soften it down a little bit, you know. It was quite complex, but to set up, you know. Mm-hmm. But I would generally work like that, and in the mixing we'd make a final decision on which vocal we'd use, you know. Mm-hmm.
Did you record the vocals all in the same studio?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they had a little vocal booth at the back of the studio. I don't know if you remember.
Yeah, like on the, I guess facing the desk, it would be on the left.
On the left, behind the couch. And it was quite a sort of womb-like sort of feeling in there. It was fully carpeted. There wasn't a lot, it was very dead.
Yeah.
Sound in there. And once again, you know, I mean, we did in other studios, we experimented with, you know, having a bit of room on the vocal and stuff. But I think in general, he liked to have it sort of quite pure and not too much kind of ambience in it. Mm-hmm. So, and it was just a short hop from that room into the control room where he could have a quick listen to how it was going and then jump back in without having to open loads of doors and go outside and, mm-hmm. you know, mix with people and stuff. So, mm-hmm. that's where we did pretty much all of the vocals.
One of the other things concerning the vocals, of course, are the lyrics, which we had no idea about until I came up to listen to the final mix with you guys. And I remember I sat down, you guys welcomed me. It felt like I was coming to an audition, actually. And please have a seat. And Scott walked up to me. He's like, here's the lyrics. And he handed me these printed out lyrics. And I realized instantly, like, oh, this is the moment where it's finished. He's sharing the text.
Yeah.
And there are all these conversations about how all of the sounds in the composition always serve the text. But we didn't know what the text was, so we weren't influenced by any themes or emotive interpretation of what he was writing about.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly, a lot of people have really analyzed his lyrics, and there's books, a lot of writing about it already, and I'm not one to really analyze poetry, but on Soust particularly, there's some quite, like, harrowing texts that have many layers of meaning that are quite frightening and like, or violent or intense in different ways, or spiritually intense and stuff like that too. But I thought it was really, that's one of the things I walked away with. Like, we had enough information from him and you to perform like our role of bringing this spectralist saturation character. But it wasn't too much information where we understood what everything was, where it was going, you know, although it was composed and just conceptually, I thought that was something that I took away from that. That was really good. Like you can get you can get more out of a self-fulfilling artist's mind if you don't define what you're trying to do in a collaboration, actually, and just trust them to go somewhere themselves, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. slightly in a way. Yeah. Do you work with the text in the recording? Or are you listening? Were you listening more to sound or phonetics? Or, I mean, did the theme of the text? I guess he would perform, his enunciation and performance did all of that as mm-hmm, musically, mm-hmm. but
yeah,
how involved were you?
Yeah, I mean, similarly, I would received the lyrics just before we were going to record the vocals. So throughout the recording process, we had our guide electric piano. And Scott was very concerned that, you know, nothing was taken too literally, which is why he hid the lyrics from us in a way. So you wouldn't be able to sort of refer to them with sonic, with a sound that you were working on, you know. So
absolutely.
So that would be the first time I would hear them, and like you were saying, yes, some of them are quite harrowing, especially when you have a few shots at recording them, you know, you keep going over this.
You're learning this.
You're learning it, and you think, like, wow, this is what I do for a living.
Yeah. Yeah, it brings a lot of other outside questions, which are distracting and removed from the flow state in that way. I mean, absolutely. It's really interesting.
Yeah.
Right? I think it's very respectful.
Yeah. Yeah.
To not bring that in to distract so people can. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's getting the most out of each lyric, the tails of the line, you know, sort of, obviously he knew how he wanted to perform them, so that there wasn't a lot of, oh, Scott, could you give this one a little bit more, or, you know, you need to bring the dynamic down here a little bit, you know, like you do with some artists. I think, you know, with Scott, he knew exactly where, how they should be working, you know.
It's monumental.
But he would sort of say, look, am I going a bit too over the top now? And I'd sort of ask it, you know, say, I think you need to just come in on the mic on this one, you know, and, you know, to get a particular sound out of the microphone, sort of working the microphone. Mm-hmm. So there was a sort of technical aspect to recording the voice that was... very important to my role, making sure that, you know, because you know what it's like, you get one shot at it sometimes and it's got to sound right. So just sort of working the dynamic of the vocal, using the microphone, using the room to enhance everything he was singing. Mm-hmm. I think you're right in a way. It was the sound of the words at that point. Mm-hmm. It's just, how is this sounding? How is it blending with the track?
Mm-hmm.
Because obviously, that's a quite a difference to the other records that you made.
Mm-hmm.
Was the actual vocal presence there and the delivery? And I'm not going to say verse chorus, you know, verses and choruses, but
the compositional arrangement.
And so
they're songs. That's the beautiful thing about
that's
it.
Right.
It's like they're very heavy and very complex, but they're actually songs. Everything on the record,
exactly.
Which with the record like Bish Bosh, it's not as clear in that way.
And
that's interesting, that's what he brought Son into too, like, oh, let's do these songs. I mean, they're not pop songs,
yeah,
or maybe they are in a certain mindset.
I think they are the more compositionally the more cohesive moments of of his solo records, you know, similar to that, when everything kind of is moving in the same direction and it feels like there's a rhythm section and everything's syncopating, you know, there's the repetition of certain phrases and then it's an interpretation of the performance and sonically, you know, and some of the tracks, you know, we process the vocal in a different way, so maybe put some distortion on it. And the other thing I love about the record is the sort of different sort of spaces around it. So, you know, it's going from completely dry to sort of big kind of wide kind of echoes and reverbs and things.
There's incredible dynamics on that record. I think it's the most dynamic that Son's been able to work with them for sure.
So that's right. What I was
spatial dynamic too.
Yeah. What I was going to say was that, you know, to actually have the power of the drones and the guitars and but also sort of combine that with Scott's vocal and kind of give both a place in the mix. You know, that's the area that I was working in to try and combine those two elements so they sounded like they could exist in the same same world, you know. That making those sounds work together, giving them the glue, that's also part of the recording process as well for the vocal, you know.
And it's interesting with this mix, the final mix, because it really, it's very generous when you give it volume on your hi-fi inner space. In that way, it's very naturalistic. There were some of the criticisms we had from Sun diehards.
Right.
What involved the level of the guitars, because in our records, the guitars are always the in the front line, of course. But in this, on this record, we were an ensemble amongst all these other elements. First and foremost was the leader of the pack, Scott, his voice. But it was at a time when I really started to understand how people were listening differently with headphones or quietly on Bluetooth speakers at the time, and listening to digital media on smaller speakers. Because if you put the vinyl, if you listen to the vinyl on a hi-fi and give it volume, everything blossoms and opens up into this massive head, into the proper headroom. It's really interesting how that happens psychoacoustically on the record.
And
at that moment when it came out in 2014, it was this time where it was like also a bit dangerous to send an MP3 out still, because it might leak and stuff like that. And unfortunately, the record did leak.
Did it?
Yeah.
I didn't know.
A few weeks before it came out, that was pretty disappointing for us. And for Scott, too, because we took so many pains to keep it a secret. Because everyone was excited just to surprise the world with this, like, wow, who would have thought this would happen? Yeah. But, and I remember he told me, like, you can only have a surprise once. But that, what I was getting at was, not only was that a risk with like new music, but people were listening to it differently too, on smaller speakers and stuff.
Sure.
So it's kind of like the symphonic element. You know, you don't listen to a symphony orchestra on a tiny speaker. It's a room. It's a space. It's a whole vibe. It's a environment, you know. It's an immersion and stuff, which this record really is, I think.
Yeah.
It really gives, it blossoms with the power that you give the hi-fi. I love that about recorded music, of course. So
yeah. It is mixed in a way, in a traditional sort of way, you know. The mixes are built in a pop sensibility,
right?
And, you know, in as much as where you can, you've got your sort of foundation, sort of harmonics, keys, okay, drones thing, and the way it's building. But we loved a mix, and always got excited, and Scott loved it when things were jumping out at you all the time, and really to very accentuated. You know, it's like, you know, he always used to say, if you're going to do it, we should just do it. You know, and that's why a lot of the records we made together. And especially on Soust, when you're listening through to this, you hear the sort of, you know, like guitar riffs jumping out at you. It's almost like breaking the perspective a little bit. So, and I think to achieve that, you can't have everything loud.
Of course.
So,
dynamics, that's the only way to make it.
I mean, I apologize to the Sun diehards. And
not all of them. It's just one thing. I mean, it's a very challenging record.
Yeah, it is. It is. And, you know, I think trying to get that much information in one mix is quite tricky. But every time you hear a song, you know, you'll hear something new in it. You know, like right down to the very quietest things, you know, like the bells in...
Herod?
Yeah, Herod. That's right. Yeah. You know, that comes in throughout the song, and it's there. You know, you can hear it. But
I love how it moves back and forth.
Yeah,
from the perception.
Yeah. So there's a lot
in and out of the perception.
Yeah. There's a lot of subtleties like that, but then there's a lot of extreme moments as well, where I think that's the beauty of having a great mix and having having those elements to work with, you know. I should maybe just give some of the other musicians a shout out as we've been talking about them.
Yeah, yeah. I wanted to ask about some of the ones I didn't meet, but the other members of Sun.
The members of Sun, exactly. Greg
Anderson played electric guitar.
Yeah.
And Toss Nievenhuizen played synth and electric guitar and did a lot of the lead guitars.
He did, yeah, yeah.
He did the both voices in the Brando opening that were that's a really interesting opening too, because the piece is about Marlon Brando,
mm-hmm.
and the reference I always understood was Marlon Brando was so beautiful and the pretty boy, but he was a real artist. And at some point he was so powerful in his contract negotiation, he wanted to break that pretty boy image so people would take him more seriously at the time. So he would write in that he would get his ass kicked in the film at some point.
That's right.
And I just realized this a few months ago when I was going back to this record, but
yeah.
The beginning of Brando personifies the whole thing.
Yes.
You know, it's like the epic singing, but then there's a kind of fake beauty in this theme guitar. It mm-hmm. sounds like Guns N' Roses.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then there's this ugly distorted guitar that's about 10 dB louder that just comes in and just like smashes down on this Guns N' Roses theme.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, well, that's Brando like tied up on a post getting whipped in a film.
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
Which brings me to the other, I mean, Toss played a pretty big role in personifying a lot of these characters somehow. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Over time, I've realized Scott used him to because he was one who could play guitar leads. Greg and I weren't so apt at that.
Right.
We're more the one finger method guitar playing, but it brings me to one of the other musicians on the album who I unfortunately didn't have a chance to meet is the bullwhip artist.
That's right.
From Brando.
Peter Gamble.
Yeah, can you tell a story about him or like how that got recorded or who this guy was?
Yes, he came up from Bristol, I think. Scott's management once again would have spent hours and hours sort of finding someone who could do it and who was prepared to do it. And he was actually, I think he had won competitions for bullwhipping. I have to sort of
I remember this too. I remember that. Like he was a kind of champion competing bullwhip artist or
exactly,
something like
that. Yeah, yeah. He came along with like a selection of whips from all around the world, you know, like an Australian rattlesnake whip, I don't know.
Uh-huh.
You know, a lovely chap an arsenal of whips, yes. Yeah. And it was almost like a masterclass. He was trying to teach us how to get them, you know, get a good sound out of them. And Scott was intrigued. You know, we both had a try, and we were at.
He was teaching you how to move.
How to crack the whip.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh wow.
And funny enough, we were at Metropolis Studios, Studio One, which is a big room. I don't know if you've been there, but it was a much bigger room than we'd recorded the guitars in.
Yeah, it's
and
great.
And we booked the whole room just for this whip. And
I love it.
Once again, it's one of those things that you don't record every day. So it was my first time recording a whip. And you're actually recording the room.
Yeah.
The shockwave, exactly. Yeah. So choice of room was really important with that. And like, tons of compression on the ambience and it's stereo and everything. And
mm-hmm.
So we spent a whole afternoon with him cracking the whip, so to speak.
It's an incredible sound. And that piece, just like all the conceptual information just stacks up so amazingly in that piece.
The
psychoacoustic like impression of a cracking whip is instant.
Yes,
that's a very arcane, ancient reaction. Actually,
And once again, quite a difficult thing to sort of to get right, you know, like punching,
yeah,
which we talked about. Recording a fist fight or whatever.
Yeah.
Or wanting it to sound like a fist fight. They're difficult things to record, those sort of things. And no, I think we got it well. And Peter, our whipper, he apparently was a expert in knife throwing as well.
Oh, wow.
So I think we, at one point, Scott said, we've got to get him on the next record, throwing some knives, you know.
That'd be a great sound.
Which you can imagine, that's a... Yeah. You know,
yeah, the vibrating, yeah, when it hits.
And then the sort of thud as it hits the wall or whatever, you know. Yeah. But, we had to make do with machetes.
Yeah.
That's maybe where... Maybe that's where the seed was planted,
yeah,
for that, you know. Yeah, so that was one of the musicians.
Make do with machetes.
Yeah. We had
Ian Thomas.
Ian,
right?
Thomas,
playing who drums.
We used a lot.
He's on the Drift.
He's
right?
he's on everything, really.
Was he on Climate or the Hundred?
No, he wasn't on Climate. He was on Tilt.
Yeah.
Drift, Bish Bosh. Most of the projects we've done, we worked with Ian.
Yeah.
You know, Scott just loved the power that he had. He was, you know, the way he hit the drums.
Yeah.
Even though he's great as a jazz player as well, and
yeah,
brilliant technician, the drums always sound fantastic with Ian, you know. You know, he's got the attitude and the patience and to kind of experiment and understand how Scott wants to put some of the rhythms together, because they sometimes they might be in time with the track, but they're not actually internally in time, so you won't,
mm-hmm,
your snare drum may not be in time with the bass drum,
mm-hmm,
and that's deliberate, you know.
Mm-hmm. Right.
so and you need somebody with a particular sort of, you know, somebody who's willing to explore that in the studio and understand where Scott's going with it, and
the sensibility to be rhythmic from where it might traditionally be placed.
Exactly. Yeah. So Ian was played on most of the tracks. Mark Warman played a lot of the keyboards.
Yeah.
And also the shaker on I think Fetish. There's like this big,
mm-hmm,
Mark's great. He would always bring in stuff that Scott had sort of maybe asked him to sort of think about and how we could do certain things. And like he just brought in this big empty can of coffee, I think, filled with beads and stuff, and uh-huh, this massive shaker, you know. So I think he played that.
Cool.
We had Guy Barker on trumpet.
Yeah, he's great on there.
Which is wonderful. And I was listening through to the album, I was thinking, where are the trumpets? You know, and then you suddenly realise that it's quite so often...
They're bends.
they're quite sort of, you know, once again, they're like little characters in the little personalities, you know, sort, mm-hmm, of not your traditional kind of trumpet lines. But but once again, all these musicians, they've really, it's taken a long time to sort of find the right people, the people who understand, mm-hmm, where Scott's going with a lot of it. And I've worked with Guy in many other,
mm-hmm,
scenarios, and he has the ability to always adapt to the project that he's working on and,
mm-hmm,
give you exactly what you want. He's got a beautiful tone,
mm-hmm,
and he's such a wonderful musician,
mm-hmm,
you know. So likewise, Andy Findon, mm-hmm, he played sax on a couple of tracks, I think, on the, mm-hmm, album, which is...
I think there's at one point the sax and the trumpet are both doing this kind of bends.
Yeah.
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 Or a tritone kind of...
Exactly.
Movements.
Yeah. My son.
Yeah, Sam. Yeah.
We met him today, yeah. Good old Sam was on...
Bull. He's on Bull. Yeah, there's Sam Walsh. Mm-hmm. And also Dot.
Yeah.
Dot Allison is on there.
That's right. Yeah. Yes, yeah, so both guest vocals in a way. Scott had worked with Dot on the Tilting and Drifting project. Actually, the Drifting and Tilting concerts at the Barbican. And I have this memory of, I'm not sure whether Dot was going to sing it or Scott, but somebody was going to sing this Latin phrase.
Yeah.
Custodium migremus.
Yeah.
And nobody was exactly sure how it should be pronounced. And I said, look, Scott, we should really check this, you know, because this is not just, you know, we're going to be listening to this forever.
And it's a powerful meaning.
It is, yeah. Absolutely, yeah. So I said, my son's studying Latin. He'll know. I'll give him a call.
And Sam was 10 at the time.
Sam
the
was
way,
10.
Listeners.
Exactly, yeah.
Studying
yeah.
Latin. That's so cool.
Yeah, so I gave him a call and I said, look, can you just send me some WhatsApps of this phrase so that we can rehearse it and make sure we're singing it and you know, giving it the right accent and translation and everything. Okay. So he sent through like three or four of these custodiant migremus sort of things, you know, in his unbroken voice at the time, and I played it to Scott and I said, you know, I quite like the sound of this coming through this little speaker, a little bit distorted, this little boy's high voice. I said, why don't we try and just lay that into the track instead, you know? And he was like, yeah, sounds like a good idea. And that's how that got on there. And
you mic'd the phone.
I mic'd the phone up,
great.
Yeah. No, in fact, I think I probably mic'd the phone up, yeah.
That's
yeah.
the way. I mean, that's the sound.
That's the sound, isn't it? Yeah. I'm not sure if I took the sound file straight off the phone. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I'm a bit of a purist sometimes. Yeah. It's like going down a generation. I don't know. But anyway, and I mean, I love it. It's like a little time capsule. I was listening to it just...
Yeah,
you know, the other day.
Oh, thinking, that's an interesting twist on that track for you.
Yeah. And 4AD actually had him sign a contract as well, just to a release form.
Yeah,
I think paid him £1. So, he's on your record.
Yeah,
he's credited on your record.
It's proper studio musician at
exactly.
Each
yeah, yeah,
it's great. I love it when. A friend of mine in Paris he plays in that band Indochine. That huge pop band.
Yes.
They did this session this year where they had a child's choir and my friend's son came in and he was in the choir.
That's incredible.
It's just amazing.
That's good. And we also...
What a great experience for a young kid to do. I mean, it's so mysterious recording. Like, what happens?
Exactly.
You know, how does it work? I mean, how does it work to make music at all? But then there's all of these really particular weird esoteric devices and language that somehow turns it into something you listen to in space, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
For a kid to experience those kinds of... Well, for anyone, too.
Totally,
it's just like a...
That's not the first time, actually, that one of my family's sung on a track, because I think on Drift, on Clara, my nieces, Scott wanted the sound of a child screaming.
Oh, yeah.
And I recorded my niece, or nieces, actually at home, screaming, getting like loads of screams for this thing, you know. Yeah, and I think if I remember correctly, Mark Warman's son, Ralph, also performed some screams on that track. So we had quite a few to choose from.
That's great.
So I think they've got a credit as well. Yeah. I've also donated one little bit of vocal, which I'm not credited for because I didn't want to be credited, but it's also on on Drift, which maybe I'll disclose at some point.
Oh, interesting.
It's kind of in your face, but I'm not sure if I should say it at the moment, but maybe at some point. Yeah.
The mystery is important. We were talking about this, like just speaking about Scott and the experiences we've had and stories. It's like, I really appreciate this conversation because it's not many people I can discuss these experiences with. Mm. I met Jarvis a few months ago, after many years. And we were at a dinner together and talked about Scott. Not only, but at the end of the night, we were both like, wow, thanks. It's great to talk, discuss, you know,
nice of you to say that.
Understanding, you know, it's really cool to share that.
I mean, it's like I said earlier, it's tough that we're not able to do it anymore because he was huge part of my sort of career. And the whole family kind of has grown up with Scott. I remember taking my eldest son to the string sessions at CTS Studios in Wembley. Doesn't exist anymore, but for the climate strings. And he was like 5 years old, took him up there and sat him down, and it's been a big part of our lives, As have you now.
I reflect on it often. It's like the paths that you find yourself on and the opportunities you have to cross paths with these people. It's really incredible and really good fortune as an artist, I think, to cross paths with artists.
Totally.
It's amazing.
And you know what's also interesting is that everyone that Scott worked with, like yourselves and Jarvis, Richard Hawley, we're still in touch.
Yeah.
And that kind of says a lot.
It does,
about the human side of what he was doing. And it really was like a family. Mm-hmm. He created this big family around him.